Sometimes you come across a band that is just so much fun that you wish you knew about them forever. One of those bands is Shukra, the Cork-based funk band, who is fronted by the amazing Sunita Appiah-Kerrang, announced minutes before I had my interview with Sunita to call it a day. So Sunita is an incredible person, an incredible singer, and just an incredible mind. So as we were talking about what it's like to be in a band in Ireland and how difficult that can be to get things going, as well as being in a band during a pandemic, we talked about her life, where she moved from South Africa when she was 8 years old with her family to live in a direct provision centre in County Kerry. She had the big life change of not only moving from South Africa to Ireland, but her whole music world changed as well, where she knew the likes of Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston in South Africa. She was suddenly introduced to Kylie Minogue, Robbie Williams, Sugar Babes. She had a different world of music to consume and to fall in love with, and to also act as a form of escapism. Learning all about her big loves from Samantha Mumba to Muse to Janelle Monáe, we learn all about the journey it took from her being a little girl from South Africa who is now part of one of Ireland's most celebrated funk bands. Sit back, enjoy just a chat with Sunita Appiah-Kerrang. So I am talking to Sunita from the band Shukra, who just announced out 5 minutes before we set up our Zoom meeting that Shukra, after 6.5 years, are calling it a day. So Sunita, yeah. How are you?
Hello, I am well. It seems like an eventful morning for me. I think, we've kind of taken some time out to kind of reflect on it. And it was something that we were kind of having conversations about, you know, even as we were releasing the album, as to like, what does the kind of latter end of the album cycle look like? We planned on doing a UK tour, an Irish tour, a couple of different things to have that sense of a milestone, like the final kind of milestone. And then, you know, we were just saying there, this year kind of happened, and we kind of took some time to figure out, like, what does it mean? Can we push it out? And it's just kind of become apparent to us that there's kind of no better time than the present. All of us are respectively doing different things. We're in different places. I'm based in Dublin now. Some of the lads are still based in Cork. And we've been kind of, you know, working on different things and opening up ourselves to different possibilities. So it just makes as much sense to have that sense of closure, as there isn't really all that much that is able to happen at the moment.
No, RTE had the live program, Songs from an Empty Room, the other week, where the conversations around what it takes to work in music, what it makes to work, what it takes to work in the arts in Ireland. It's so much work. It's your passion project, your job, on top of a few other jobs as well. And because the bottom fell out of the music industry and the arts industry this year, we have to kind of rephrase or readjust how we actually support artists. So could you kind of tell me what it, like, because you released your debut album last year, Shukra, which is unreal. It is the most fun, it is so sexy, and it's so political. Like, it was such a perfect statement album that captured just the madness of the last few years, which has now been completely outdone by the madness of this year.
Yeah, pinnacled.
What would have been like an average year? What would have been the average year for you guys? Like, especially considering like a big summer of festivals as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I suppose like the way that we kind of try to approach it or think of it was, definitely in terms of kind of like a cycle of some sort. Like, if the summer kind of pinnacles the peak gigging time and stuff, like, what releases would we want to have out by then? How, you know, what are we actually going to work on, an EP, an album? This was like the first time, obviously, that we committed to something of this, something of this magnitude. And, you know, it was also exploratory because we hadn't like written an album together, or none of us probably had been in a context where we'd written an album before, actually. So whatever timelines it is that you give to it, you kind of find along the way that there's just different, you know, quirks or things that kind of come out and push them. And because of the fact that we were largely doing it as a DIY project as well, so a lot of the lads in the band, Dermot, who plays the keys, and Emmett, who would be the drummer, and like everyone, to be honest, but they were the kind of ones that carried the weight as far as like production, like revising what you record and then just doing more arrangement around it and stuff like that, or kind of just, you know, fine tuning things. So an average year really was kind of like, you know, what committing to what it is that we think that we're going to do, an EP, an album, in this case it was the album, And we actually got very strategic about it just based on historical kind of experiences of trying to, you know, create an EP, and us being a 5-piece band at different stages. We were 6 and 8 and 9-piece band. So we just really realized like how time consuming it can be, how, you know, how you could kind of deliberate on lots of things for ages. And we just kind of set up very stringent rules around, as we were like making the album, we'd like say, okay, every 3 months, we're going to just like keep writing, see what happens out of that 3-month cycle. You know, however many, you know, songs we write with the aim of maybe writing like 6 or something in that period as a minimum, is however many we write. And then we'll vote on it and kind of just narrow it down to the best ones, or the ones we felt most comfortable being representative of Shukra. And it kind of felt serendipitous that we called it Shukra in the end. We didn't know that obviously starting off. We didn't have any sense of a concept or a recurring theme that would run throughout it. But yeah, as you said, you know, it's representative of a number of different things. That was also just because we were writing it in different periods. Like there was kind of quarterly cycles of writing things, narrowing down what we felt was most relevant and more representative of the sound that we wanted to put forward as our first kind of large body of work. And then the same kind of rule applied, you know, as far as like voting on names, you know, photographers to work with. There's so many kind of components that are not strictly making music or not strictly performing. Some of that we were learning, other aspects of it we'd had experience with, and you're trying to kind of fine tune on what the last thing was that you did that you saw being successful or not successful. So yeah, as you said, it's a full-time job, and some of us had full-time jobs, you know? So it's a hard kind of balancing act, and you have to be super committed to it, which we were. And by the end of it as well, we were like, you know, no matter what happens after the album cycle, we were going to take like a hiatus anyway, like just to rest, just to recoup, because, you know, in the creative world, and I'm sure that you can attest to this to some degree, the definition as to like what your day is and the definition as to like when is enough work for any one day is really loose. You could keep creating, you could keep doing things, and, you know, that poses up questions of mental health and kind of, you know, managing yourself a little better. So we saw it as appropriate as taking a rest. And then as we actually had this period of, you know, forced period of restfulness, we were kind of like, actually, you know what, like evaluating everything, maybe we're cool, maybe we're done for the moment. Yeah.
Because festivals and gigging is just so important for Irish bands as well, because unfortunately the exposure in media isn't always on the side of Irish acts. So you kind of,
right,
there's a lot of responsibility on you to kind of get out there. And kind of like you said, like 6.5 years ago, like you all met in college, wasn't it? In UCC?
Yeah, exactly.
So like the lifestyle of a college student is so different to someone who's like a few years out of college. And
yeah,
like that definitely like takes its toll on where you want to go and how you want to, like if you're endlessly promoting yourself. What I want to really know is kind of like, would you wish that there would have been more support maybe from Irish media along the way?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we've kind of like thought about, talked about, and mulled over for a while. So like actually recently I was having this conversation with someone else that wasn't from Ireland. And I'm pretty sure whenever I heard this fact, it was a couple of years ago, I don't know if much has changed, but like, for instance, even just in terms of like the quota or ratio of Irish music that is played on you know, radio stations versus international music, I think that a lot of other European countries, you know, when you go on holidays and like you're in Spain and immediately it feels like Spain, because radio station also has like a lot of localized music, and that's because the predominant like popular music is probably localized. And that's upheld because of the radio stations, I think, having a quota of what ratio of like local music they play to international music. It's that you're creating a certain demand for what's going on at home, and you're kind of expanding the remit of what it is that people have exposure to. So I think that there's a problem in that inherently, that like we tend to kind of, you know, or historically more so, I think there has been a kind of a change in the tide in the last 5 to 6 years, because people have seen this qualitative stuff that's actually able to do well outside of Ireland. And that's kind of that had been historically, I think, the mode of how we appreciate or valued our own music, is that like, you do know it's class, you would probably support or like listen to it. But as far as advocating it, like on kind of wider platforms that can actually, you know, broaden that range of sustainability that artist or, you know, creative person in theater, or whatever else has, it's a tougher conversation to have. You have to really persuade people. And so it kind of nearly seems as if it's just as well for you to go outside of Ireland, go to the UK or the US or whatever else, try and make the impressions there. And then, you know, the natural kind of placebo, or like, yeah, the knock-on effect of people appreciating hear what happened. So, I mean, to answer your questions, I think that we did have a lot of support just because we were new and a bit different and interesting. But I think that the sustainability of it kind of died down in that maybe people didn't really know as to like where that sound had a place in the kind of the landscape of Irish music. And I think that that also has only become apparent in the last couple of years, because there have been more acts of different sensibilities of R&B, hip hop, all these different people doing something really that's like different, not only in the case of like, you know, the Irish music landscape, but also just generally in the landscape of like urban music widely. Like it actually stands out as being, you know, pointedly Irish and telling very unique stories. So I think that we kind of make sense now more so in the context of what, you know, of the music that we make, more so than like a couple of years ago. And I don't know whether we were ever going to be the band that was going to like not only just like make that statement, but also pave the way as far as like what the scope for that music could be or could represent in Ireland. Like maybe we were figuring out that just as much as, you know, other people in the music scene were.
Was that like incredibly frustrating, like to see the way, like particularly like the last 7 months, the conversation around, okay, well, we've kind of around Irish artists, but also about kind of diversity and representation in the fact that you're a female fronted band, you're also a black woman, and that you previously maybe you could have been sort of pigeonholed into a category. Yeah. When like you guys are a body and soul headline act, do you know that kind of way? Like I could see like in the Woodlands, it's just beyond me that the conversations that we are having in Ireland are just like so behind in terms of the possibilities that we could be doing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we really kind of like to put ourselves through the fire as far as like the durability of like that, you know, the faddishness of like our sense. So there's a sense of belief and kind of like appreciation for the fact that there's this like change in the waters, but also there's a bit of like doubt around it. I think that that kind of also comes down to the inherent like self-deprecating Irish mentality that we kind of have, which is part of our charm, but maybe part of some of the stunting elements of our kind of nationwide charisma. I don't know if I would say that I find it frustrating as far as that like we're so far along the lines and it's hard to figure out as to how you would kind of catch that wave and kind of like re-amplify yourself as being like part of that initial movement of things kind of getting so much more interesting and stuff. But I mean, I'm ultimately kind of happy that those conversations are happening, and that like I just think that like, you know, so like I'm not necessarily ancient, but like I'll call the fresh kids, like the new kids on the scene and people doing stuff that's interesting. They really seemed to have like taken stock of the world around them, not only in context of like Ireland, but like in terms of like, you know, if they're making weird and kooky or interesting music, whatever the genre is, they have watched their, you know, the people that they've admired and kind of picked up on all the cool things that are successful that they've done and kind of incorporated that very naturally. Some of that wasn't necessarily as natural to us. So like, I think that it's a twofold thing of that there are more doors being open, and that is ultimately a good thing, because like, we're still going to be creative. I would hope to be able to benefit of that as someone that has been on the scene and just kind of go, okay, cool, this is great. Now that we have the room to, you know, to give room to a lot of different, you know, styles of art, I'm going to capitalize on this for sure for myself. But also I just think that the bar has been raised as well, right? Like, I mean, I even noted it as we were creating, even like 2 years ago, I was like, shit, like the scene is blossoming, but like we actually have to up our ante as well, because, you know, because this, you know, the bar is rising, people have been calibrating and taking stock of what's going out there and picking and choosing the best of what it is that they like, and from the off then being really successful. Like you've the likes of Alex Go, and like obviously the Soft Boy crew, and like all of these artists that just really seem like they're already refined and polished by the time that they have like put themselves out there. And that's the astounding thing, is just like how high the caliber is on an international scale as well as like locally. You're like, oh wow, these people actually have the range to go all the way. And so yeah, I'm like pretty happy that people have that opportunity to capitalize that, especially where it's, you know, it affects anyone in the kind of intersectional space of being like a black female, you know, like whatever the case may be, that those stories have more room and people are actually curious enough to like listen to them.
And in terms of actually being within Ireland, so when did you move up to Dublin?
In the last year and a half or so.
say the difference in like the Cork music scene and the Dublin one? Would it be in like, because Cork from the outside, like that is such an incredible, I feel like it's a really diverse scene in Cork. Like there's just so, there's a lot of funk and there's a lot of soul down in Cork. And I don't know, was moving to Dublin, was that kind of in the back of your head to kind of get a taste of a different music scene?
It was kind of like that. Like, I mean, yeah, Cork is like a massive hotbed. And I would say that Cork is just basically the foundation of like my music education in a very broad way, like not only just purely from what it is that I was performing, but just generally talking to people. Like when I studied there, so it's literally the home of my music education, but also just the people that I got to be friends with and just the widening of like genres and knowledge that people had. Like, I would say that like Cork is our like music nerdery capital in a sense, and that kind of nearly retains like an element of Puritanism about like how people approach it, you know, and what people create out of it. Like there's a lot of raucous and cool things happening there, and it preserves itself and people really, you know, cross collaborate strongly, so it's really cool as to what's happening there. I think I kind of came up here as well knowing that we were in the middle of making the album and kind of towards the latter end of like the recording process and the producing process. I was just like, I actually felt that personally, I'd done my time in Cork, but also that it was necessary to move up to Dublin in some way in order to kind of understand a little bit more about the infrastructure of how people, you know, work with each other here. Because that's the thing as well, is that like, that's another kind of comment I'll make, is that like, you know, aside, I think that media wise and the institutions that are there are totally there and supportive towards what it is that you're making, whenever it's good and whenever it's like making a difference and it's cool and stuff. But I do find that there's a certain amount of rapport that you also just have to have, or that you kind of just need to be really visible. So either you make that compromise of just really, you know, doing the trek if you're not living outside of the, you know, if you're not living within the kind of Dublin circuit or like the Dublin kind of Leinster circuit, or else you move up just to make yourself more available, because there are just more gigs. It's a bigger, you know, it's a bigger scene, or there were at least. So I kind of came up because I felt like it was a natural move as far as wanting to do something a bit different, wanting to be somewhere else, and also just wanting to have more music accessible to me. Cause I was nearly, at one point I was doing like 2 or 3 trips up to Dublin a month, kind of a thing, to like come to gigs as well. So especially like in the R&B scene, you know, if it was like Anderson .Paak or the Internet, all these like festivals as well, you know, it just kind of felt like it would be easier accessed while living in Dublin. And I definitely felt that I've understood that more. Like I've just been able to solidify friendships with other musicians that I had good kind of vibes with over the years. You meet them at festivals, you meet them whenever they're down in Cork and stuff like that. I was just able to like broaden the range of the music community that, you know, we're part to, and yeah, have the opportunity to work with people, build better relationships, and kind of understand as to like what's required to, you know, to do well in the scene here.
Do you think that this year has made conversations between other artists a lot more honest? Because like I've been noticing so many new collaborations where I think actually people just reaching out online as opposed to hoping that they can say yes at a party, or say hello, at a party or like a festival. Like there does seem to be a new burst of kind of creative energy.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's like a humbling experience as well, right? Because like there is a cycle that you kind of just get to as an individual artist, as a band, wherever else it is, you know, you create some stuff, you do all the components to kind of like market it. And then you're then on the gigging scene to try and like make up, you know, make money to like sustain yourself, but also to like also recoup some of, you know, what it is that you invested from a time and energy and monetary perspective, you know, pre-putting stuff out. And that like, it's like any other kind of working cycle. You get in the grind of it and stuff. And it's a very pointed decision to take time off. And it's also a very pointed decision to do anything new, especially if you have like a winning formula. So that can kind of create that sense of like an insular kind of scene where people only kind of collaborate or, you know, build relationships in a certain way. And this particular, you know, scenario with the pandemic, I think humbled everybody as far as really realizing just the precarity of your lifeline as a performing artist on a consistent basis, if that's what you're doing. And then also like pushing people to be really creative. I just actually am astounded by like how quickly people have also been able to respond and how ingenious they've become as well, as far as putting themselves out there and creating these new avenues to perform or to do not even performative things, but just like give more of themselves as a personality, like support me as an artist. I'm a full rounded thing, like, you know, and I'm like more power, you know, more power to people exploring all of that. And also it's so much work, because you're actually really putting your, like if you're an artist, you're like really putting yourself fully out there and stuff like that, so it can be a bit exhaustive. So I think that everyone has had to be humbled and kind of be creative around, one, how they think of themselves, what their brand and their music and what they're all about and how they serve the community, to feel that connection, because everyone on the community site needs it just as much as the artist needs it. And then trying to kind of have that honesty even with your community, that like, look, I'm a living, breathing person, I have bills, I got shit to do, don't know how I say shit on this, I need your support to carry me over to the next point that we can be together in a live situation. But then also within the music community, I think that everyone also has been extra supportive of one another, extra open to exploring that, because you just have the time and the bandwidth to be like, well, shit, like, we don't know what's going to happen in the next while. Like, this is a perfect opportunity to, as I said, you know, work on a totally different vein of music to what you're usually used to doing, and do that with someone else that you've respected in the scene. Certainly I think that there's like a lot more vulnerability as well as honesty around, like, we kind of all need each other. There is an ecosystem going on here, and like, this is your part to play as far as supporting me, both as an artist, or, you know, an artist speaking to an artist, or an artist speaking to like the community of people that like support and like their art.
The idea of just recording and working from home as well, I think there's been a bit more transparency from people with how you actually make things. Like, if everybody now has to set up like a home studio,
right,
you are going to have the people who work in studios honestly giving you the advice on how to do that. Because it's been like a reset, I think, because, you know, we can't really go into studios. We can't make the way we used to. So we have to be told the tricks.
And absolutely.
That's kind of incredible.
Yeah. And like, I think there's also that like element of everyone being a bit more forgiving as well, you know, around things like that, because there can be a sense of nerdery as far as like, there can be a sense of like, you know, you're supposed to know all these things and stuff, but you've never been placed in that situation to have to really apply it, even if you did know how to set up, you know, recording gear in your room and stuff, and like, you don't know how to maybe maximize what your like home domestic environment kind of situation would be, because maybe you're only recording demos and now you have to, you know, really try make this worthwhile. So I think that like in the general landscape, like loads of music and art has kind of come out of this whole period, and I find that even interesting, like looking at like, you know, within Ireland, but also at like international big stars. You have like Charlie XCX creating an album out of this time, and it's a totally different feel to like what her brand or her style of music would be and stuff. And you kind of, you take it as a standalone thing that comes out of this particular era. But then, yeah, like I think that it kind of, it builds a bit more humanity for like what the standard is, and just how ingenious and creative people are trying to be even in these adverse situations. And because of the fact that you need it a little bit more, you need a bit of an escape from what the world is at the moment, like, you know, you're more forgiving, because ultimately here is a gift that someone's like giving to you, or someone's trying to engage with you in some way that's like honest and real and brings light to the mundanity of the day or whatever, and you appreciate that all the more, you know. So I really hope that some of that kind of that more human aspect kind of filters through even beyond this particular period of whatever this time is, because there's a lot to be learned. I think that there's just a bigger appreciation for, hopefully, I think, I definitely have appreciated it more, but then I'm biased as an artist. I'd like to think that, you know, laymen that may or may not be that interested in the arts previously have seen another side to it where it's like, actually, this is like, it has value, you know?
Yeah, and like in terms of say Charlie XCX making, recording, writing her entire album from her own home, I think I think if anyone had maybe doubted what Charlie XCX's role in her own music was,
it
completely reaffirmed that she does everything.
Right, exactly. Like, and that's the thing as well. It really like that would be the most surprising act. I was just like, holy shit, you know, like. Oh, you assume that these people have like loads of money in a private studio that they could just go to, and like a car that they'll just chauffeur from like their door to. So like to see broadly like independent artists and like, you know, fairly popular artists doing these kind of ad hoc, you know, homemade artists kind of, it reveals the level of talent that they have. And again, like just the range of, you know, the range of creativity, like, you know, being a photographer, just like seeing different, you know, new ways of them expressing art and being like, holy shit, didn't know that the person was capable to do that. That's like, you know, solid.
Or the ability to actually make something within kind of a confined space in a way. Like I would find it hard to think of, say, Justin Timberlake being able to make an album. Like, I feel like he's not able to reduce his world to put all the kind of bells and whistles. Whereas, people who've had to work hard in that way before, they're able to adjust, they're able to make an amazing album from their bedroom, and
absolutely,
and it could have been made in a big studio because you don't know the difference. Like, it's magic.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that really kind of, like, again, it raises and sets the bar. I also think that it's also, like, cool as far as, like, you know, the music process from a creative prospect can be kind of, like, it's a beautiful one, but it also can be, like, an arduous one as far as, like, you're trying to create this body of work and, like, you're trying to kind of refine it so that it's, like, the most shiny diamond or whatever by the time that it's released. And you can kind of invest a lot of time on deliberating around, like, that process and kind of second-guessing yourself. Whereas, like, in some way, I think that, like, you know, that is important, obviously, to kind of make sure that you're, like, putting into it the best that you can and getting out of it, like, something that really can stand the test of times. But I also thought that, like, there was something really cool. There's another artist as well. Mainly I've been paying attention to female artists, this other UK artist, Etta Bond. And she has this whole EP that actually is, like, coronavirus or pandemic themed. It's called Two Meters Apart or something like that. But, you know, again, it's just like, she just wrote these songs and they're simple and they're kind of jammy and they're fun. They're not that intellectualized or all that smart, but it's just really nice to see that people are willing to put things out there and like that people will enjoy them, you know? And even if there's like one or two songs that just aren't like the most polished or great thing, that, like, you know, it's okay to create and to feel that there's an element of inconsequentiality, that, like, whatever you're doing, it's still expressing and, you know, it's still got value and someone probably will like it somewhere. So that's another thing as well, because, like, I think that that's often that's the thing that kind of delays or kind of, you know, you hear of, like, artists working on a thing forever and ever, and then they delay it, push it out, and there's all these different statements made because they just, that's kind of coming from it, I think, often from, like, a capitalist perspective where it's just, like, it has to be, like, the top selling thing and it has to be this amazing thing. And there is a value to that. But also, like, on the other hand, you know, during this time, it kind of also just reveals to me that, like, just, yeah, creating something that's honest and that speaks to the times and that kind of people can relate to, whether or not it's, you know, an iconic Aretha Franklin album that, like, every piece of it was just, like, so considered that everything's perfect. Like, it could still be, like, people will fuck with that music too. And, like, that's the thing. I was just like, shit, like, this song is literally Corona, what have you done? I could be sitting on a beach with you. And that is my mood, like, that, you know, you've said the words and I'm just like, yep, that's what we're going through. But yeah, like, yeah, I've certainly been kind of learning and kind of just being like, yeah, there's an element of you can be loose with yourself as well as an artist, not to feel this massive pressure to have this crazy production thing because the standard is so high, that you can just do something that's honest and heartfelt and speaks to a time, and you know, people resonate with that too.
So let's talk about you. When was, because your voice is phenomenal, and I've always wondered about singers, where, like, at what stage did you know that you had this voice that could be just used in so many ways?
So that probably would have been whenever I was like 5 or 6 years old. I apparently was a very obnoxious and very kind of full of myself 6 year old, which I stand by. Is trying to return to that person, actually. And I think there was a Christmas concert singing Silent Night. Don't know why I connected with my voice. I was like, I really like my voice. And I just kept, like, giving loads of sass and vibrato to Silent Night and, like, assuming that it was a solo, but it was just like a class of 6 year olds singing it as their Christmas. And, like, I remember the teacher kind of kept giving me side eyes, like, bitch, calm down. But yeah, I think that was the moment where I was like, I enjoy singing and I love Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston. And I think that this is closer, like, this technique kind of aligns my voice closer to, like, that type of a voice. And so from there on in, then I felt like I really took an added kind of interest in music. And I remember there was this South African, so I was born in South Africa, grew up there up until I was 8. I moved here. But yeah, prior to that, I would have watched this channel, which is called Channel O, kind of like an MTV base or whatever. It's just a music channel that was local. And they would have, like, all of this, like, different R&B and urban music. Mainly at that time, Mariah Carey and, like, Whitney Houston were the, you know, women of the pop world. And yeah, would just be singing along passionately to their music. And I remember, you know, saying to my mom, it's like, I want to be a singer. And she was just kind of like, yeah. So I think from there on, I kind of badgered them into, like, investing in me. Like, can I get singing classes? Can I get a piano? Like, can I be creative? And started knowing everybody with singing. And yeah, and, like, even though there were, like, other, I think that, like, so similarly as well, I would have kind of maybe had a sense of reservation about admitting that I wanted to be a singer beyond the age of like 8 or 9, mainly because my mom was like, I'm not taking you to school to be a singer, like you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer, an architect or something. And I was just like, yes, mom. So yeah, that was kind of the beginning of it. And from there on in, I suppose it's just been something that's that I haven't been able to let go of.
And are your family creative? Are they musical, or were you the standout?
No, they would be pretty creative. My mom would have been a singer. She's a great, incredible voice as well. And we would have like sang in church and stuff like that, like kind of that quintessential, you know, urban music tale. Like grew up, you know, in a church environment, very Christian environment. And singing was just something that was done in the house anyway. My mom would have sang a lot. She would have been in bands whenever she was younger, but never really kind of took it anywhere. And yeah, so then like singing kind of came naturally. It didn't feel like it was a weird thing to do as such. My youngest sister is an incredible singer as well, even though she wouldn't necessarily have thought of herself as being the singer. She has this crazy voice, and actually she's working on some material as well. So who knows, we might see that in the next year or so. But she's also an incredible artist, like drawing. And that was something I was relatively good at as well and really liked to do. But yeah, my sister is like incredible drawer. She did art in college for a while and as a singer. So I think that we generally in our family kind of had an inclination towards that visually, like, yeah, visually and kind of, you know, musically, anything that in any way kind of triggers out of the box thinking and a little bit more of an experience, I'm definitely drawn to.
And then when you moved to Ireland then, because the choir and kind of like church setting would have been quite important, mm-hmm. Was that, when you were in Ireland, did you kind of feel that gap then?
It actually was able to transition relatively well. When we moved to Ireland, so we moved to Dublin, we spent a very short time in Dublin and then moved down to Tralee to a direct provision centre there. And within that, there were obviously other African and kind of other communities of people from different places. And there was a church that would happen actually within the direct provision centre at that time. So we landed there and actually that kind of just tends to happen across the board, especially where there's any kind of community of like, probably like African people, like you'll find. So I don't know, I'm not going to speak to like the breakup of how religion is in Africa, but it is a very Christian kind of country, or else Muslim or Catholic Orthodox Christian, like they kind of tend to form like the massive religions anyway, nowadays anyway. And so basically anywhere that I've gone to traveling, like I'll always find somehow that there's like a Pentecostal or like a Catholic kind of African or like international church, as well as like a Pentecostal or Baptist, and they're kind of more of the different forms of Protestant churches and stuff. So we found one of those anyway in Tralee and went to that. So there was that sense of like music and being able to continue singing in that way, and I enjoyed the choir there. I think it was just a shift though in terms of like what it was that I was surrounded by, because South Africa has its own huge music scene. So I actually wrote down like what were the kind of first things I would have been listening to as a young person in South Africa. Yes, obviously the international stars like Whitney Houston and Mariah Carey, but like there was this genre called Kwaito in South Africa that was really big whenever I was growing up. And within that, it was kind of like post-apartheid, like this whole new kind of urban and contemporary, not quite like hip-hoppy, but kind of borrowing from some of the production elements of that, but like very South African. So Kwaito was what it was called, and it was kind of a dance music. And I remember one of my favorite songs when I was really, really young was like, It's About Time is the name of the song, and the band was Boom Shaka. And I used to sing that all the time. So it was that world of music, but then my mom was really into gospel. We grew up in the church, so like artists like Brenda Fassie, who's like, she was massive South African star. Rebecca Malope, again, huge big South African star, but Christian South African music was like really big, like that's nearly like pop in itself. They were like the names of the music that I was like growing up with. And then whenever I came here, I remember one of my very kind of poignant or vivid moments of like, again, my music sensibilities kind of continuing to flourish in Ireland was like watching, I don't know what channel, probably was RTE2 or something like that, and Kylie Minogue came on and la 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 la, that song was on. And I just remember just being like, ah, one, didn't know who Kylie Minogue was, didn't really know if the UK pop and British scene, so that was all really new to me. So like I felt like I had this like massive obsession with like watching Kylie Minogue and Robbie Williams, the Sugar Babes, because like the Sugar Babes, I remember their very first song that kind of crossed over in South Africa, and that was the only one I knew, and I really loved it. And then I came here and they were like way bigger than what I thought they were. So like all of these like girl bands and like early noughties Britpop, and now you know, all those Now CDs and stuff, like I was obsessed with buying all of those. broadened my exposure as well to like more Americanized and kind of, you know, Westernized music on a kind of bigger scale, because that was just like the predominant stuff that was played on TV and radio. So yeah, it was kind of less of a shift of like music community, and just more that like it really expanded it. And then I definitely was like way more focused on like pop and R&B and stuff like that, kind of really took over my music preferences.
And in terms of kind of like accessing kind of like pop culture and like pop stars, like living in a direct provision center, like was that a like a hard thing to do, or what was that like?
It was like, so the thing, I suppose, whenever I talk about direct provision, it's kind of like, yeah, like I definitely reckon it's probably some part of like a weird trauma, to the point where like I don't really know as to like, sometimes I have a hard time actually like pinning down the true essence of what it was like growing up there, because I was like 8 when I moved here in that context, and I had no frame, like what is direct provision, literally I've never heard of it, so I didn't know what it was. So for, in some senses, my adolescent self, and like also I think that this is like maybe in the very early stages of like mass migration happening in Ireland.
Was this still in the 90s?
Yeah, that was like 2001, let's say. Like, so like, you know, definitely lots of people were in the country, but I think that like it was really escalating at that point. And I remember 2003 then felt like a very poignant year as far as being like an immigrant year, because they really like changed loads of the laws around how you could get citizenship, like some of those laws around if you're like born here and stuff that you're not really entitled to it, or like different really tricky kind of difficult laws came into place and kind of changed how direct provision, I think, also worked. There was, it doesn't exist now, but there was a direct provision centre in literally Ballymullen Barracks. So the Ballymullen Barracks would have obviously been an army barracks, and there were loads of different caravans there. But these caravans, one, hadn't really been exposed to caravan, hadn't seen one, like had lived in houses in a home all my life up until that point. So it kind of felt like a weird holiday retreat that just went on for far too long. And as I was growing up, I was just like, what is this, you know? So, you know, when I was 8, I was like, there's just a bunch of kids, there's this playground out the back, we live in this small little caravan, it's kind of weird, but like, you know, everything was just so weird and visceral, and like, I had no way to contextualize it, so it was really unlike any other experience. So in some respects, whenever I first moved there, I was like making friends with Czechoslovakian people, I'd never heard of this place, I'd never met people from here, Romanian people, Polish people, other people from other parts of Africa that I'd never been to. And so there's this like romanticized sense of like, it was just like this mad playground, and my mom was really stressed and kind of generally stressed with the whole situation, really stressed with like where we were and just trying to kind of like bring us up in this like weird context. And then the other side of it is also seeing like the effects of that after like we'd been there for like 2 and a bit years, and my mom was like very depressed, just seeing loads of emotional responses. I kind of grew up a lot faster than I probably needed to, because I had to like make meals and stuff. Like, we had a caravan, so there was like some stove and stuff in which you can make meals and stuff, but yeah, just it's a twofold thing where it was just like, there are loads of kind of fond memories that I had as far as like relationships that I built and contextualizing Ireland and understanding a bit more about the wider world that I lived in. But then as you grow up as a preteen teenager, then a couple of years down the line, one, that's not a natural state to kind of grow up in, I don't think. And then processing kind of somewhat adult, you know, understanding of like where you are, what your opportunities are, realizing that like you have so little money that going on a school tour was this awkward thing where your teacher would give you money to like get a, you know, like a souvenir and stuff, and just like awkward things that you're like, ugh. Like, we came from a middle class background, so it felt even more jarring in the context of just being like, why does everyone perceive us as being like this, like, you know, charity case? Why are we living in this really kind of, you know, like the holiday period has kind of left. My mom is just in a really bad place. She kind of is depressed and cries and all this kind of stuff, and she's really trying to kind of do a lot of stuff. So there's just like all this confusing stuff. So as far as access to like what you're saying as far as like the pop world and all that kind of stuff, I very much latched onto it as a form of escapism, I'd say. We had a TV in the house. My mom had for a tiny period gotten Sky, and then it got expensive, she cut it off. And I think that like that was like really like, because even at that stage I remember writing songs, and my sister and I would joke about it, like that I was writing all these songs about really mature kind of subject matters, like lies won't kill me anymore, and like this traitor boyfriend that I fictionally had when I was 11. And like, I think that we just very much escaped into that world. Like, I was obsessed with being a pop star and obsessed with, you know, pop and R&B and stuff, to the point where like I kind of have this archival knowledge about like music from the era of 2001 to 2004, because it was really just a form of my just like latching onto a different narrative or aspirational living and stuff. And so I really valued that, because that was like, again, a kind of a musical, you know, education in a context where there's very limited of resources for me to actually get extra, you know, resources pumped into my musical education if I wanted it.
To be a music lover and to move from, so you would have kind of a lot of Christian music in South Africa, kind of Christian pop music, and then your Whitney's and Mariah's, and then suddenly to arrive and be like, oh, there's this whole other world of music that I can just consume right now. Like, to be able to, like, I think this also proves the importance of channels like RT1 and RT2 have music, because if you don't have Sky,
Pop Cahir.
Like, so important for a terrestrial telly to actually give access to people music that other people are kind of consuming through MTV or whatever. Like, was that, like, do you, was there, who was the big artist that, like, I know you mentioned Kylie and Robbie, but who was your big person when you were like 12, 13?
J-Lo, Samantha Mumba as well. So, like, whenever I was kind of coming to, like, the Kylies and the Robbies, like, Samantha Mumba was, like, in the peak of her career. And I remember lying to my friends in secondary school because, one, they were super gullible and and I was a pathological liar. No, and I was just like, yeah, you know, Samantha Mumba is my cousin. And they were like, oh, my God, really? And I was just like, yeah. Everything was believable because I was new and it was novel, and I was just like, yeah, no, like, I mean, obviously we don't talk because she's a celebrity and she's busy, but, you know, she's my cousin and she's Irish, and, like, I just moved here and from somewhere, but, you know, I'm her estranged family. Was obsessed with her because, again, you know, it's this representation of someone that was like, oh shit, there's, like, black people here that are not me and my five friends. And that was a big deal. So definitely grew up loving her on a kind of local level. The band that were, there's a whole lot of loving going on. Six, is it? Yeah. Like, all of that era of TV kind of becoming a big thing. I, like, oh, You're a Star as well. Loved it. So, like, was definitely, like, latching onto any, like, any products of that era of music, like, locally. But J-Lo and I would say, yeah, J-Lo, Kylie Minogue, Destiny's Child, obviously. They were, like, the big pillars. Like, they were, like, the top, the creme de la creme. And then, like, the tiers kind of that felt closer to me or somewhat accessible would have been, like, the Robbies and the Kylie Minogue's, because they were in the UK and the Sugar Babes and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
I think the importance of Samantha Mumba as an Irish pop star is just never really addressed as much as it should be.
Has not been, yeah. She's, like, in the canon of, she pushed Ireland on the map at a time of, like, you know, like, you think of, like, late 90s, early noughties pop and just how crazy it was. You know, when you watch music videos from that time, you're like, wow, like, there was so much money going into, like, making these futuristic music videos and all this kind of crazy stuff. So it's like this, like, crazy, excessive, cool, futuristic, the millennium's upon us kind of era of pop music. And she was there. She was, like, heralded as one of the big names at that time. And I think it was a big deal in a sense, but it, again, it kind of comes back to that thing of, like, you know, Asher, that's great, but, like, not really being like, yeah, that potential is, like, within our country. There are so many other people that have that blossoming, you know, ability to be that kind of a star. And I don't think that she gets the recognition that she deserves.
I think it's also kind of interesting as well, because she was managed by Louis Walsh, and he's like, you know, you wouldn't really think of him, even though he's managed some of the biggest acts in Ireland, he's a businessman. But I think it's amazing. So he would have created Boyzone as a response to take that success, and then and created Westlife to kind of carry on when Boyzone were kind of breaking up
that legacy.
And then Samantha Mumba kind of arrived when Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera were the big American pop stars. Right. And I think it's amazing that our response to the big blonde bubblegum bombshells in America was this Dublin girl whose mum is Irish and her dad is black, and she has a Dublin accent, and she's not singing like soppy love pop songs. Like, Gotta Tell You is such a cool song.
I know, it's
so cool. And and the fact that existed in that time, with Louis Walsh managing her, it's like,
like, he's a shrewd businessman, I'll give him that, to be fair. He's fucking on it, in a sense, or he captured that era and, like, knew how to respond to it, and I knew who to pick to be that. I don't know, but also, like, I mean, I guess there's also an element of, like, you relate to what you relate to in another sense as well. Like, she was an anomaly or a new thing, like the last person that you might have known of that was very different as far as like being a representative of Ireland was like Thin Lizzy, who again, in, you know, in the like what, 60s, 70s, like much as he was celebrated in like the absolute peak of his success, and also at like more so probably in his death, you know, and what that signified. And also probably because again, you know, in his era of making music, Jimi Hendrix, who people who, if they connected with him, at least Thin Lizzy was like this local representative. So there was this, you know, culturally there was this like, if the Jimi Hendrixes in the age of this revolution and stuff like that is like an icon alongside the Bob Dylans and whatever else, then like Rory, you know, Rory Gallagher is like the equivalent of the Bob Dylan, and like, you know, Thin Lizzy was like the equivalent of the Jimi Hendrix locally. In that time of like kind of plastic pop and all of that commercialism, what was being put out to you was largely kind of, you know, Western Barbie ideal kind of poppers like the Christina Aguilera's, the Britney Spears's, even Destiny's Child, as much as they were big, kind of like didn't have the same level. I don't remember the same level of obsession on it in Ireland anyway, being present about Destiny's Child so much as like Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera's, I don't know, I can't remember other people that were, you know, popular at the time. So I think it also was just a case of like pop culture, like it's a signifier for like what was the palatable and kind of like where the appetite was for different types of artists at that time and who was like heralded right at the top. And then also people just being like, well, I relate to, you know, that person because like I see myself in the Britney Spears, I see myself in a Christina Aguilera or whatever else. And Samantha, while she's great, like just didn't maybe hit home for people because no one was questioning themselves. It's so interesting, like looking at, like, you know, you look back on different eras of like music or art. Like myself and my sister watched a really old movie last night with Hugh Grant and someone, I can't remember what it's called, something Blue Eyes. Basically, he falls in love with a girl that whose dad is a mafia.
Yeah.
Mafioso.
Is it Johnny Blue? Mickey Blue Eyes.
That's it. That's it. Mickey Blue Eyes. That's the one. Yeah. And we watched it and it was just funny. I was like, you know, back in the Poverty Channel days where you'd just be hanging out at home pre the internet and pre any of that, you'd watch that and love it and just be like, that's funny. You watch it now and you're kind of like weighing in on so many elements of it that might be problematic in the lens of your watching and being critically thinking about things now, you know? And like, it doesn't mean that you enjoy it any more or less. Like sometimes you can enjoy it just as much, but just be like, okay, I can acknowledge and see that. But like, I think that we do have a totally new lens in which we reflect upon all these kind of things and kind of go, oh, wow, I was susceptible to all of this. And like, you know, I played to the construct of what was being sold to me. And that's fair enough, so long as you can kind of recognize that and kind of, you know, see it for what it is. So yeah, but hopefully now she should like, there should be like a walk of fame and she should be knighted.
Whatever our version of dieting is,
whatever the equivalent is. Yeah,
like where did your appetite kind of like for music then take you next? Because you like you are quite like you're like such a rich, your voice is like such a rich R&B thing that
yeah,
you couldn't have been listening to Kylie Minogue then.
Yeah, I think that like I kind of got, so yeah, I kind of went from like all the kind of UK and pop of that time into like got steeped in more of the R&B of the time, probably not very left of center R&B, but definitely like the Ashantis, obviously the Destiny's Child. I also really loved like older music as well. So my godparents, when I moved here, I kind of, my mom befriended a bunch of different people from Kerry, and my godparents are two Irish people in Tralee, and they really love like Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye, all this kind of older stuff that like, even though I knew of them historically kind of on like classic gold Sundays on the radio kind of a thing, I never really spent any time going into the discography of their work. And these guys were like, they had a lovely record player and they had all these like cool, you know, unusual records or like, you know, rare presses of this, that and the other. And I kind of informed, also I fancied a boy that was really into it too. So that also, I felt like when I was reflecting back on like my musical education, it's like, wow, it's so funny to like see how meandering my tastes went based on like if I was obsessed with a boy and then like if they were like, yeah, like listen to, I don't know, Muse or something, then like I just went hard on Muse for a while. And then I was,
oh,
just
everyone
like,
yeah, had a Muse phase.
Yeah, exactly.
Three albums, they slap, like they're good.
Unreal. Yeah, exactly. After that, I was like, you know, it's fine. But yeah, exactly. And like during my teenage years, when I was like 15, 16, myself and a couple of friends had like a kind of covers Muse band as well. So that's also kind of some of the weirder. Yeah.
Re-singing Matt Bellamy's vocals.
I try, you know, what's that song? It's a New Dawn, it's a New Feeling Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that was like one of my go-tos for any kind of a thing, and like doing his weird like all that kind of stuff. I can't do it now, but yeah, all of that kind of stuff I was really into. And also just playing around with like with the sound of my voice and just torching it, like trying to figure out as to whether I could try and achieve, you know.
So I think it's mad that Muse's cover of Feeling Good was probably a lot of people's introduction to Nina Simone. Like,
I know. So yeah,
thanks Muse, I think.
Hey, listen, if you're broadening everyone's range and they eventually, yeah, like totally, exactly. And that's the thing, I felt like that was the version of it that I definitely would even probably now sing to some degree. And then like, you know, the internet came and I like went and looked at older versions. I was like, oh, okay, that's
well, even like the piano arrangement on that version of Feeling Good is just phenomenal, because like it is,
yeah,
like I think I can assume that you've a real love of just like multiple genres. So the fact that they brought the dramatics of, because they were quite like an indie band, and they're classically trained, and then his voice is just like alien.
And it is, yeah.
And the fact that he could kind of put the pain of being like this like tortured white boy and be able to match it with the pain and the sorrow that Nina Simone has.
Yeah,
it's impressive. And like, whatever about Muse, what they did next, singing about I think that's when I dropped out with Muse. I was just like, oh god, you don't live on Mars.
I was never one for sci-fi. I was just like, I could appreciate sonically that they were doing things, but I was like, I'm just not gonna listen to these albums as much. But also keep, you know, go forth to the next planet and beyond.
Yeah. Symmetry, an important album for many people.
that was basically one of my favorite ones. And then I kind of dipped into kind of like more of the sadder emo stuff. So like, yeah, I'd say like went hardcore into like mid to, you know, early noughties R&B, Snoop Dogg and Justin Timberlake, you know, Justin Timberlake and Pharrell Williams, that era of Pharrell Williams collaborating with like loads of different people. Snoop Dogg had like a great couple of albums with him. N.E.R.D. Just like that era of Nelly, like rap then was way more of a thing. I was into it, even though my mom was like solidly trying to shut it down. Got into that, you know, 50 Cent, all that kind of stuff, you know. It was really into that kind of the stuff that was really popular.
Yeah,
and then like somewhere
hip hop then really.
It was, yeah, exactly. Yeah, like loads of names were kind of emerging and I was just like all for it. And yeah, and then like at the same time consuming a lot of like old school stuff like Nina Simone, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, the woman that sings I Can't Stand the Rain. I can't remember her name right now.
Peebles. Ann Peebles?
Yes, Ann Peebles. Yeah, stuff like that, that like really had way more of an impact on me as far as like finding my voice, like finding things that suited my voice. And then also contextualizing it with like Alicia Keys, who like, you know, there was also this like new age of like neo-soul really becoming a predominant thing. Like, you know, Alicia Keys, like, you know, fecking Neo, like all this kind of stuff that was referential of it. So I was kind of seeing the threads connecting as far as like this old school soulful stuff that like I kind of knew of. And then this neo soul that like was borrowing from that nostalgia, but giving it a fresh essence with the hip hop. So I could see like the interlinking of all of these different things. I really like loved all of that. And then like come whenever I moved to the countryside fully then at that, whenever I was going to secondary school. And then that's kind of where I kind of got into like indie and kind of just like kind of wider music genres than what I would have naturally been exposed to, especially if whenever I was in primary school and in church community in Tralee, there were like way more black people. In the countryside when we moved there, there was just like way less, and we just didn't really go into town quite as much, form friends with people here and just like listened to whatever it is that they were listening to. And you know, got into Death Cab for Cutie, Muse, who are that band with the like, there's so much emo music at that time. Oh, Fat or something. They used to be in One Tree Hill a lot. Their music used to feature in that a lot. Fall Out Boy.
Oh, Fall Out Boy.
Yeah. I was like, Fat Boy Slim is not them. And then by the time I kind of went to college and decided that I wanted to do more music, it was kind of being exposed to like friends being into like math rock and like some of my friends really being into like heavy metal and also just like the whole world of like metal and all the kind of subgenres that fall in that. I was just like, okay, this is hardcore, and like I still can't remember or define listening to any of it, like what's going on, but still being very curious about it and curious as to what it was that they latched onto it, because it was just so far removed from like soul as far as like a very constructive and kind of very visceral music that you respond to. And then like this is also very constructed and visceral and like lots of things happening, but I was just like, what is actually happening here? So I think I was always very kind of curious, at least, and relatively open to understanding like what it is that people that I liked and cared about were listening to, and would give it at least the time of day for a little while to see whether it was something that like fit for a suit to put on. And then by the time, when I went to college, then I really kind of figured that I liked, I liked a lot of weird, disruptive, like stuff that just kind of has a little bit of discourse either in subject matter or even like the arrangement of it, that is just doing a little bit, you know, something a bit different to the status quo within whatever that genre it is that it belongs to. And I got really into jazz then, because I felt like jazz kind of married like a lot of different elements of all of these different music, you know, styles that I had been exposed to and kind of liked, in that, you know, it has the structurelessness of maybe some, you know, parts of like heavy metal and kind of hardcore stuff, and even psych rock and kind of solos and all this kind of stuff, but also has a lot of structure. It has all the kind of tonal weirdness of, you know, rock and R&B and blues and stuff, but then at the same time was very kind of regimented, and like depending on what era of jazz it is that you're listening to would be very kind of sweet and like very soulful and stuff. So when I started doing music like in third level education, jazz was one of the things I really latched onto the most and was like, this is me. I think I want to be like a jazz singer, a contemporary jazz singer. At the time I was also starting to discover people like Esperanza Spalding, Gretchen Parlato, and they were like, there was like this new wave of contemporary jazz artists that were fusing like R&B and just different, like even just world music, and incorporating it into more standard songs and kind of creating this like new sound. And I was really into that, and I was like, yeah, if I want to be a performing artist, I think that I want to either create music of this sort that like is kind of harder to place but you still gravitate towards, and that just allows for you to like not be too rigid in any one particular genre.
I was listening to your album when I was running this morning. Fabulous album to run to. I don't know. Do you listen to your own album actually in that way?
I don't really. Sometimes I kind of get into the mood. Like there's a couple of songs that like I will secretly be like, I like that song, I'm gonna stick that on, you know. But yeah, really, I kind of just get like weirdly embarrassed by it or something. I don't know. It's weird.
with Flex, like I was just like, this, you,
oh, yeah.
You bring such an energy of Beyonce's course on Telephone with Lady Gaga, that like
it's
where it's just so kind of like raw, and but it's just so powerful as well. And yeah. I love that you can reach that within that part of yourself to paraphrase another song, to bring that big bitch energy, like just it's amazing that the thing, and you are able to, that you can see it, recognize it, but also like release it, like it's amazing.
Yeah, it's fun. I certainly would say that, like, again, like speaking to all of the kind of different musical educations, they definitely have like formed a part of it. Because sometimes I'll write a song and I'm like, that was what I had to say. I guess that was what I had to say. Okay, cool. You know, so there's times where I'm just like, you know, again, like I did a bit of stage school and drama and stuff like that. I feel like big bitch energy definitely speaks to that. There's a couple of songs that are like, even, you know, Flex and stuff, and the kind of like ghostly weird nature of it. I really loved Janelle Monáe as well, actually, as a teenager. And that album I felt like was definitely like, it was the defining moment as far as like, oh, there's this like female artist who's like so stated in her.
Android.
The Arc Android, yeah, that was like one of my, like that, and I kind of came upon that and Kanye West's late registration at the same time, and maybe India Arie's like first album, and I think that those ones were like on my Discman. I was just like playing them on rotation pretty much like for a whole year. But the Arc Android was certainly one, because I was just like, whoa, like this 24-year-old who wears this like uniform that's like referential to her like parents and the uniforms they have to wear in the jobs. Like there was so many things going on. I was like, it can be politicized, but it can be pop, you know, it can be performative and like referential of James Brown, but it could be so contemporary and so weird and have this whole other narrative that just doesn't make sense and is kind of sci-fi and stuff. So that, like, you know, I definitely, by listening to the likes of her and other things, like I can feel that education kind of like well embedded in the, you know, in the internal organs of like of myself and what it is that I like latched onto and loved. And then the big bitch energy and like even Jerskophobia and like how dark and weird it is and stuff like that, that there are moments where I can kind of retrospectively be like, oh yeah, I can kind of see the threads of all of these different styles, you know, weaving in together and kind of forming like what my particular voice is or what it is that I like to do with music. I'm grateful to all of those people.
Yeah, because it's like, it is like there's a whole new generation now of musicians where like just fusing all these genres together is just like so important. The same with Janelle Monáe, because like she's a big nerd, like big time, like that whole, like the fact that she was just tying in, like she loves jazz, she loves R&B, she can rap, She is massively into like science fiction, and like also the same with Anderson .Paak. Like, it's those crossover acts that I think is why people need to have like a big wider education of music. What is the plan? What's the next plan for you kind of musically?
Yeah, I mean, exactly that. I think that it's certainly going to open the door to my kind of investing more time in doing that. Like, I would say that over the last 2 years as well, like, I have been writing, I kind of tend to write bits and bobs, and I've had like different iterations as well of collaborating, like even while being in Shoe Cry, I was in another kind of outfit called Lake Rama, and that was more electronic kind of ambient stuff. So like, there have been instances of my exploring different sounds because I was just writing stuff, and then someone kind of comes up and, you know, and then it seems like a timely moment to collaborate. I'd say with the last 2 years, like even as we were writing the album, I was like writing other songs. I was like, this isn't Shukra, and I want to explore what that looks like. And I'm still doing that. I think that I think that this, like the announcement today, in a sense, obviously is a, you know, it's a sad one and it's a milestone. For me, like, I think we've been processing like different feelings and thoughts around that and kind of mulling over whether we wanted to do that for sure. And so now I kind of feel like I can give myself over to being like, okay, that's fine. We've done our time. You know, it's all good. We came and did what we said that we wanted to do. And then kind of like resting from that and then trying to figure out as like, right, like, if I'm writing things and if I want to do that, like, what does that look like? Who do I want to collaborate with? I have a kind of loose idea. I really want to try and put out a body of work that like is mainly with all women, and trying to figure out as to like who would be the producer, like who would be part of all of that, and also what skill sets am I going to flex and kind of try and, you know, develop towards that. So it's, yeah, with that in mind, I'm kind of like trying to just take stock of it and like watch and listen and see, you know, who's doing things, and then try and kind of make my calculated moves then. I'm definitely using this time as well, especially this year, to maximize that and like discover what that's going to be like, and try and do as much of the work as I can do, so that next year when things resume and life is normal, hopefully, that there'll be something to show for it. Yeah,
it's so nice to know that even though it is sad that Shukra ending, that to acknowledge that a band has achieved what they wanted to do. Even though there's been many hardships within the kind of music industry within Ireland and now within a pandemic, that I think it's really important to just appreciate the work that you've achieved. Like, it's incredible. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Louise. I really appreciate it. Yeah. And I'll also say the lads are also up to stuff too. So I think it's not necessarily the end of anyone doing anything. It's just new iterations of what that looks like and what it's going to be. It's going to be a good time.